I hate to tell you this, but it turns out that traditional bed sheets can harbor more bacteria than a toilet seat. I know, very disgusting. Not only is it extremely gross, but it also leads to acne, allergies, and stuffy noses. Miracle Made offers a whole line of self-cleaning, antibacterial bedding, such as sheets, pillowcases, and comforters that prevent up to 99.7% of bacteria growth and require up to 3 times less laundry. If you get hot at night, you'll appreciate Miracle Made's self-cooling properties, which makes use of silver-infused fabrics inspired by NASA. If it's good enough for the astronauts, it's good enough for me. They are thermoregulating and designed to keep you at the perfect temperature all night long. It makes a huge difference in getting better sleep every night. If you hate sleeping in bacteria, which I'm sure you do, or you're looking to get rid of your worn and uncomfortable bedding, you should check out Miracle Made. You'll feel like you're tucked into a luxurious hotel fancy bedding situation, but it'll be a lower cost than some of those other brands. Go to trymiracle.com/thestacks to try Miracle Made sheets for you or a lucky loved one. Order today and save over 40%. Plus, if you use our promo code THESTACKS at checkout, you'll get 3 free towels and save an extra 20%. Miracle is so confident in their product that it's backed by a 30-day money-back guarantee. If you aren't 100% satisfied, you will get a full refund. Upgrade your sleep with Miracle Made. Go to trymiraclemade.com/thestacks and use the code THESTACKS to claim your free 3-piece towel set and save over 40% off. Again, that's trymiracle.com/thestacks to treat yourself. Thank you, Miracle Made, for sponsoring this episode. Welcome to The Stacks, a podcast about books and the people who read them. I'm your host, Tracy Thomas. Our guest today is Ariana Davis, the author of What Would Frida Do? A Guide to Living Boldly. And she's the digital director at Oprah's online magazine. We talk today about Frida Kahlo, creativity, and yes, a little bit about Oprah. Reminder, The Stacks Book Club book for December is Citizen, an American Lyric by Claudia Rankine. And we will discuss the book on Wednesday, December 30th with Darnell Moore. This week, I'm shouting out a handful of our newest members of the Stacks Pack, the folks who support the work of the show through monthly contributions on Patreon. They earn perks like our virtual book club and discounts on merch and a lot more. If you want to join, head to patreon.com/thestacks. Today, I'm saying thank you to Megan Vineyard, Tiana Brunner, Elizabeth Cruikshank, Megan Bainbridge, Raylan Torngren, Chris Hode, Sarah Peterson, Elizabeth Winter, Julie Chigbrow, and Rebecca McFadren. Thank you again, and thank you to the whole entire Stacks Pack. Without you, there is no podcast. Okay, on to my conversation with Ariana Davis. All right, everybody, I'm here today with Ariana Davis. She is the author of a brand new book called What Would Frida Do? Ariana, welcome to the Stacks.
Thank you so much for having me. I have been so looking forward to this all week.
I'm really excited to have you. You've let me know you are a fan of the show, which always makes me really excited. So there's a lot of mutual excitement today. We always start in the same place. So in about 30 seconds or so, can you just tell me about your book?
Sure. What Would Frida Do? Is, I like to say, part self-help, part biography. It looks at the lessons that we can learn from the life of the iconic artist Frida Kahlo. She obviously is someone who was so far ahead of her time and was an icon as a queer feminist, Latinx, all of the things back in the 1930s. So it basically just looks at what can we learn from her all these years later in 2020. That was 30 seconds.
That was very hard.
I feel like it's 32.
No, you've done it. I never hold anybody to that. And sometimes people go really long, and then sometimes the time constraint makes people go really short, and they're like, my book is about Frida. And I'm like, okay, not helpful. No, that was perfect. Right on. I'm curious about writing this book now. Why this book now? Why did you feel compelled to tell this story? Sort of how did you come to this work? Because, you know, as you mentioned, it's the 1930s that Frida Kahlo was sort of doing her thing. So, you know, it's like not 50 years later. It's not, you know, like, so I'm just sort of curious how you decided.
Yeah. So the process happened a little backwards for me. And I like to share this story just to be honest, in that the publisher actually came to me with this idea. So they So Seal Press, which is an imprint of Hachette Books, they had this idea that, you know, in this time of kind of where women are finally being encouraged to be their most bold, authentic selves, they were interested in just the enduring legacy of Frida Kahlo and how she, as an icon, is just like someone who, even as we said, she's, you know, died in 19, she died a long time ago, and she, yet still decades later, it's still such a, we see her face everywhere. She's on tote bags and murals and mugs, and, you know, she's all over Instagram and Pinterest. So they were interested in publishing something around her legacy, but they were looking for the right writer. So actually my agent had heard through the grapevine that I was a really big Frida fan, which, you know, you're a huge Frida fan and people like hear through the grapevine that you're a Frida fan. So she basically reached out to me and said, hey, you know, I wondered if you might have any ideas. Are you interested in writing anything around Frida? And so at first I was a little hesitant because, like you said, I kind of was like, why now? And also there's been so many books that have been written about Frida. There was a movie with Selma Hayek that was nominated for Oscars. Is there anything that I can contribute to the legacy of this artist that we already know so well? And then the more I thought about it, the more, you know, over time, as I was kind of considering it, I would just be on Instagram or I would be on Pinterest or Twitter, and I would just see kind of random people either misquoting her or posting like random quotes that seemed very out of context, or, you know, just posting her image. And I realized that I did feel like there's a new generation that maybe doesn't know her story as well. Mm. And I also felt like she just has such a complex story for someone who was so far ahead of her time that it does feel like there's so much there to mine as lessons that we can all learn from now. And so together we came up with this idea of what would Frida do, in that, yes, it's, you know, looking at Frida's life and it is part biography, but I did also want it to be a source of inspiration for anybody who, you know, in these times that we're living in, this was, you know, I wrote the book before the pandemic, which is like, it, you know, it ended up being something, I think we all need inspiration more now than ever, but even before the pandemic had started, you know, it felt like we're just living in a time where I think women and women of color specifically are finally being encouraged to like be bold, live your life authentically. But how can you do that? And, you know, who are the women that we can look to for inspiration? And I feel like Frida is one of them. So that was kind of how it all came together. And I came up with this idea of what would Frida do? So to tell her story to a new generation, hopefully, but also just offer a little bit of inspiration for anybody who needs it.
That's such an interesting origin story for a book. I think you're the first author to ever say that the publisher sort of came to you with the idea. Do you know if that's common? Have you heard of that happening, or is your case sort of a rare one?
It does happen. I think that because, you know, my day job is as digital director for Oprah Magazine. And I think, you know, that has given me a little bit of visibility. And, but even actually my publisher mentioned that they had followed some of my writing when I was at Refinery 29. And so I think for books like this, where it's about a real person or it's based in, you know, history or it's a nonfiction book, I think it is, I wouldn't say super common, but I think it is quite common for either publishing houses or agents to look to journalists or look to, you know, writers who have an established repertoire to work on a project like this one. So I think the fact that they had followed my work and that they heard through the grapevine I was a Frida fan also helps that I'm Latina. So I think that I think it was kind of a combination where they reached out and were like, hey, like, you know. And at the time, you know, we had actually just launched OprahMag.com, which is Oprah Magazine's website. Hadn't existed before. I know it's hard to believe, but we launched it in fall 2018. So my life was literally, I mean, I was literally like already working crazy hours. And so at the time it was like the idea of writing a book, which is something I've always dreamed of doing since I was a kid. But I was just like, I don't know if I can do this now, the timing. It's a book about Frida Kahlo, which is going to take so much crazy research. And so at first I was a little bit like, I don't know if I'm going to be able to make this work, but then it was literally like this fell into my lap. So it was like, I was like, I'm not turning down the opportunity to A, write a book, and B, write a book about Frida. So I made it work.
That's so cool. I love that. And I love that you kind of took, I love, at least this is me putting words into your mouth. So let's see. But I felt like in reading the book, you took her biography and you also were like, look, I'm not a biographer. I'm not going to be able to add anything to the history of this person that people know who's been researching all that. So what can I bring to the book? And I felt like you brought this really great energy and you brought sort of this, like, I don't know, maybe you are, maybe you aren't, but like millennial vibe. I am one, so I don't say that disparagingly, but like you brought sort of this fun, playful energy and this fresh look on the art and the person. And I thought that was really cool because I definitely, when I picked up the book, was sort of like, what is this person going to tell me about Frida that I can't already find out about her? Like, it wasn't like all of a sudden there was this new drop of information before you wrote the book. So I like that you sort of took, you didn't just fall into the trap of doing exactly what someone else has done, but you were like, what can I bring to the work? And that really shines through because it is a unique take on art and artists that we love. And I sort of wish there were more books like this about other influential people who maybe we quote a lot or maybe we think of their work a lot, but we can't quite understand them in the modern, in our modern space. Like, who would Frida have been if she was alive now, you know, in her prime now? So I appreciate that you sort of, made it your own, if you will.
Thank you for saying that. I definitely did that, I think, very intentionally, because as you said, when this first came about, I think when I first started writing, I very much was like trying to be a serious biographer and was like, you know, pouring through the research and like, just like I was so caught up in the idea of like getting it right and making sure that I didn't miss anything and that everything was factually correct, because she is someone that we know so well through movies and books. But there was a 1983 biography written by Hayden Herrera that is actually the book that the movie is based on. And that's kind of like the gold standard, like 600 page biography about Frida. And so the more I was writing, the more I was like, I can't write this as just a straight biography. That's already been done. I'm not adding anything to that conversation. What is it that I want to say? And what can I add to the kind of carrying on the torch of her legacy in my own way? And so that was when, I think when I shifted my perspective that way, that's when I started to actually have some fun with the book, and it felt like fun. And I think once I actually got a little bit creative and just started to actually have fun as a writer, you know, fiction is my first love. I never thought that my first book would be nonfiction. I always, you know, I'm like literally like, you know, started my love of reading began with like The Babysitter's Club and always has just been fiction. And so my dream has always been to write a novel. That's always what I wanted to do first and foremost. So the fact that this kind of landed in my lap in this way and that I ended up with my first book being fiction, I think that part of the creative approach that I think I took to the book was that love of just like, you know, being imaginative and having fun and telling a story that's maybe a little bit different than like the typical story.
Yeah. I have a very specific question about Frida. So sorry if this is a little in the weeds. It's not a spoiler, everybody, I don't think. And maybe it is.
I mean,
if you don't know
spoiler alert.
Yeah. If you don't know anything about Frida Kahlo, this might be a spoiler. But I'm really curious about Diego Rivera's affairs and also sort of how that has played out publicly. Because in the book, I mean, you focus a lot on his affairs. And I think that that's something that maybe people know, is that like she was famously cheated on a lot. I didn't know it was with her sister, but like, you know, there's a lot of transgressions going on. And I'm curious why Frida's affairs don't get as much play publicly, like why she has sort of become like this like scorned lover, even though she was also off like doing her thing. And I'm just sort of curious, like, why you think that might be.
I think, and I even grappled with this a bit with writing the book, because I, as the writer and being a woman myself, you know, I was very aware of not wanting to, like, for lack of a better word, I was not interested in slut shaming or like, you know, she was somebody who was very sexually fluid and was somebody who, you know, had a lot of lovers and had her own affairs. And so I wanted to make sure to tell those stories in the book without, you know, making it seem like, look at all the people Frida slept with, you know? And so, but on the flip side, I also was, which I nod to a little bit in the book, it was kind of like good for her, because Diego was out here, you know, doing way, way worse. And I think that she does get this reputation as scorned lover because she was, you know, always so vocally a proponent for Diego and loved him so much. And so much of her art was about him. And I think the heartbreak that he brought to her life. So I think that for people who don't necessarily know the ins and outs and her backstory, those are the things I think that stick out the most. And I do think the story of him cheating on the sister, all of those things I think make us automatically kind of team Frida. And so it's like, it does, we do want to focus on more of it being about how she was scorned, but the reality is she also did her own things. But to be fair, in my research, from what it seems as though, you know, her doing her thing wasn't until Diego was doing his thing first. So I think that it was like she was, you know, in love with him, and she did marry him with the understanding that he wasn't necessarily always going to be faithful. But I think that she thought of it as like, and this is just my interpretation based on everything I know, but I think she thought of it as like, he might have an indiscretion here or there, but like he would keep it away from her versus like he was just out here straight cheating and like everybody knew it and it was very disrespectful. And I think she got to a place where she was like still heartbroken over it, but still then kind of was like, well, then I'm going to do my own thing. And it, their relationship was so toxic and so messy. And I think that's the one thing when I talk about the book and the inspiration I want people to take from it, I'm like, I like when we say what would Frida do, it's not meant to be like live your life like Frida did, because obviously she did a lot of things that were very messy, right? It's not, I'm not saying like you need to have like, you know, a toxic man in your life like Diego. But to me, what I took away from their from their love was at the end of the day, like Frida was so unapologetic in the way she loved Diego. Like she, that was her man. She didn't care that people called him the elephant to her dove. She didn't care that, you know, he, what everyone else's opinions didn't matter to her. It was all, it was what she wanted and she didn't care what other people said. And so even though I wouldn't agree with it, even though I wouldn't have taken back my husband after he cheated with my sister, all of those things, I still can appreciate that she really loved him and that their love was passionate and she chose that route for herself. And so it's, you know, again, not my choice, but the fact that Frida chose that unapologetically, it's like, I guess good for her.
Yeah, because I think you make that really clear in the book that a lot of the things that she did fully and completely. And, you know, while she might have had doubts or she might have had fears or anxieties, I mean, she certainly struggled with, you know, depression and other things, like, or that's what it seems like, at least. She still was very bold in her choices. And like, if they were wrong, they were loud wrong. And I just want to say, I am not slut shaming Frida, if that at all came across. I actually, quite the opposite, was curious because she gets that rap of being like this scorned lover and like this, like, yeah, she's the dove and like woo woo woo, that I sort of was like, wait. She was out here fucking everybody. And like, we should be talking about that, because like, sure, Diego was a hoe, but so was she. And like, that's a quality in a really big way, like that they both were able to go out and be sleeping with everybody and like to do their thing on their own. Like, I don't know. I'm here for it. And I wish there was more of that. Like, I wish we talked about that more when it comes to her, is that like, because also she was physically disabled from polio and then also from this accident, this bus accident. So I think like there's this idea that people who are injured or who have become disabled or are born disabled or whatever, that they aren't sexual or that they can't be sexual. And so I think part of the Diego stuff is like, he was cheating on her because she couldn't have babies and this and that. And it's like, well, she could not have children, but she also was not having a lot of sex. Like, she was out in these streets, and like, good for her.
She really was. One of my favorite quotes, there's, for anyone who reads the book, there's like some design kind of pull quotes that come out. And one of my favorite ones was, make love, take a bath, make love again. Like, yeah. I just think that's so simple. And it's like very, and it's, it just, I think, like you said, Frida was very sensual, was very sexual, but I agree that I think over the years she has been, she's kind of become this symbol of just like pain and weakness. And it's like, no, she was like a badass, fierce woman who also was like very in touch with her sexuality, with both genders, with whoever, you know, she wanted to. And she was, and this was a time also before labels, right? So she, the fact that she so openly, and everyone knew that she was fluid and that she just cared more about, you know, embracing her sexuality with whoever that might be before, you know, having to put a label on it, I also think it's something that is why she, you know, years later has also become an icon for the queer community as well.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm glad that you said all of that, because I do think that the way that history sometimes sanitizes people based on one thing or another is boring. And I like that she's complicated and that there's lots of different parts to her. And there's, you know, not just sexuality wise, but again, you know, mental health and physical ability. And also her art was really varied. She wasn't just doing painting. She was also doing, what were they called? Lithographs.
Yeah. She definitely experimented. And she also, when it came to her art, it was like, you know, everyone was dying to, again, put a label on her art. They were like, she's a surrealist, she's this, she's that. And she always was just like, I, you know, don't paint dreams or nightmares, I paint my own reality, is one of her most famous quotes. And I think that that is real. It's like, she was not so much interested in painting for like the art community or trying things just to appease, you know, whatever whatever was trendy at the time. It was like she was literally a storyteller telling her own story, and her mode was just on canvas, which I think is so interesting.
Has the book changed from where you set out to write it to where it is now, like when you got started? I know you went to Mexico City. You talk about that. You went to Casa Azul, which is was her childhood home and is now the Frida Kahlo Museum. So how did that experience of kind of researching and going there change the book, if at all?
Yeah, it changed the book completely, to be honest. I think that was the turning point for me, and from going from trying to make it this like more straightforward, like I think the original, my first start at it was like straightforward biography with like a little fun and a couple lessons. But I think I was about maybe like probably a quarter of the way through, maybe almost half. And I just felt very blocked. I just felt like creatively, I was like, there's something missing. I just feel like I am not giving this like my all. I'm not giving it all I've got. And I just felt a little bit stuck. I think a little bit of writer's block, for lack of a better word. And then, you know, as I was writing, I just remember, I think I was writing something about her home, La Casa Azul. And I remember just feeling like, I just was struck with this thought of like, I need to go to Mexico. Like, it's just like, I need to go. I was like, I have to go. I don't feel like I can write a book about Frida. I've been to Mexico City many times. I have been to La Casa Azul, but I just felt like during the process of writing this book, it was really important for me to go to Mexico and to try to just like channel some Frida energy and to also just do research and also make sure that I was getting it right. One of the things that was really important for me also is, yes, I'm Latina, so I'm biracial. My dad is Black, he's African American, and my mom is Puerto Rican, and I identify as Latina, but that's not the same as being Mexican. So that was another thing that I wanted to really make sure that I got right, was making sure that I, you know, researched her heritage, that I really understood her culture, and that I did my due diligence and paid respect to that. So there were a lot of reasons both for that, and then also just for wanting to kind of give myself a set of fresh creative eyes, that I went to Mexico City, and I treated it as like my own little writer's retreat. And it was also helpful because my day job, again, is working for O. So during the process, it was really hard to carve out writing time with having such a busy day job. So I literally just like took the week off. It was like my vacation from work. And I stayed in Coyoacan, which is the neighborhood that Frida's from, in like a little Airbnb. And during the day, I would spend a lot of time at La Casa Azul, just like taking notes and studying different things. And I went to, also, there's another museum, the house that her and Diego lived in San Angel, which is connected by a bridge. That's also now a museum. There's some different like libraries and bookstores where I could find rare books about Frida. So I basically just like spent the day either doing research or just walking around, like just being very writerly and like wandering the streets and like imagining, you know, if I was Frida, like what would Frida be feeling, and just trying to like soak up that energy. And then at night I would literally just write and write and write. And it was probably the best thing I could have done, honestly, for myself on a personal level, just to even unlock, I feel like, a little bit of like a creative wall that I think was up, and just disconnecting from like social media and from work and all of those things, but also just being able to really say that I feel like I really did my research and I did my due diligence. And that was where the intro of the book came from, where I talk about, you know, what it was like being at La Casa Azul and feeling like Frida at a lot of times during my process was with me. I think all of those things really came because I took that trip to Mexico. So I think that was really like the turning point for me, where, again, I think that was when I really started to actually have fun with the book and enjoy the process versus it feeling like this chore of writing a Frida biography.
So after you left Mexico for that week, how much of the book's actual writing did you then do? Or did you get a good chunk of the actual book written while you were there?
I did get a good chunk written while I was there. I think that after that point, I wrote like the intro, and I think I wrote several chapters while I was in Mexico. And then once I got back home, I think that kind of new perspective that I have, I went back and edited a lot of chapters that I had already written. So it was kind of a combination of like starting fresh and also then like going back and kind of editing some of the stuff that I had done. So a lot of it was, I think, written already, and like just for some of the more straightforward biographical things that I had written. But then also like every chapter is set up where, you know, every chapter is a theme. So there's, as you know, there's a theme about, you know, there's heartbreak, there's creativity, there's love, there's sex, there's identity. They're all themed. And so just going through each chapter and making sure that I really felt like each chapter felt alive and that it didn't just feel like a biography. And then also each chapter ends with just some fun facts and just the lessons that I, as a Frida fan, took from writing this book and from studying her life. So I think that a lot of the biographical stuff was kind of already done, but then I kind of went back and really just like had fun and looked at it, I think, from a new perspective.
That's very cool. While you were here in the States after your trip, where did you do a lot of your writing? Did you go to a coffee shop still? Were you still out in the world, or could you hunker down in your home and do the work there? Like, kind of how did you recreate a creative space for yourself?
I think my two creative spaces, one is my desk. So I live in a studio apartment in New York, which Tracy is looking at right now. It's literally studios. It's just one room. So, on a practicality level, I did usually end up just at my desk in my studio a lot of the times, but actually not long before I started writing the book, I live in Long Island City in Queens, and they had just opened a new like community library. Literally, like it was almost like it was like God was like, hey, like you need to get out of your apartment to write. I got you. So there's literally this little library that just opened, and it has like the most beautiful views of the city. So that was also another place where I would get a lot of writing done. So it was pretty much between those two places. I did the coffee shop thing a few times, but I think for me, I think the majority of the writing of this book was definitely just like at my desk, that library, and then while I was in Mexico City.
Very cool. If you could have the audience sort of take away like one big thing from the book, I know you mentioned sort of about Frida's, her, you know, not just having been a scorned lover or whatever, but was there anything else sort of like on the whole about Frida that you would hope your audience would be able to take from this book?
The strongest quote and lesson I think I took from Frida while writing this book, she had an accident when she was 18 that left her, you know, with a lifetime of illnesses and surgeries, and she was never able to have kids because of it. She had a husband who, you know, she had an extremely toxic relationship with. She died at a young age. She never really got to see her own fame before she died. I mean, there were just so many obstacles that she had in her life and challenges and difficulties. And yet the thing that always strikes me is that in her final painting that she painted before she died, she wrote the message Viva la Vida, which means live your life or long live life. And so for me, I think the reason why I really connected to Frida so much and the message that I want people to know is just that she was somebody who had so many obstacles and life challenges, and yet she still had this positive outlook on life somehow. And sometimes, like even now, like I've been having a rough time in this pandemic and with the racial reckoning and like things in my personal life, there's just like a lot going on. And some days I just wake up and I'm like, all I really want to do is watch Netflix and just feel sorry for myself. But then I think about the fact that like Frida, with all of those things that were way worse that she had in her life, she still managed to have this outlook of like, live your life. You only get one of it, like long live life. And the fact that she, even knowing that she was going to die soon, managed to put that message out into the world, that is what really sticks with me. And I think that that's the main message that, or takeaway that I hope anyone who reads this book might get, is that like, you know, whether you're a Frida fan or not, this is the story of somebody who went through so much in her life and yet still managed to live her life to the fullest and still recognize the value in living boldly and living your life your own way.
That is so well said and so good. We're going to take a quick break because that was so good. We have to just let that marinate for a second and then we'll be right back. It's important to me that the supplements I take are of the highest quality, and that's why for almost 4 years now, I have been drinking AG1. Unlike many supplement brands, AG1 is constantly searching for how to do things better. They're at 52 iterations of their formula and counting. Their team is always trying to find better ways to source, test, and find the best quality ingredients available. So many people have asked me if AG1 is actually the real deal. And trust me, there's a reason why I've been drinking it for so long. Quality for AG1 isn't just a buzzword. It's a commitment backed by expert-led scientific research, high-quality ingredients, industry-leading manufacturing, and rigorous testing. At each step of the process, AG1 goes above and beyond industry standards. I know I can trust what's in every scoop of AG1 because they totally obsess over product quality, the standards of manufacturing partners, and sustainable practices. Taking care of my health shouldn't be complicated, and AG1 simplifies this by covering my nutritional bases and setting myself up for success in just 60 seconds each morning. AG1 ingredients are heavily researched for efficacy and quality, and I love that every scoop also includes vitamin C and zinc to support my immune system, which is so important for me, especially with the germs that the mini stacks have running around and going to a cesspool called preschool. I've stayed partnered with AG1 for so long because they make such a high quality product, and I genuinely look forward to drinking it every single day. So if you want to replace your multivitamin and more, start with AG1. Try AG1 and get a free 1-year supply of vitamin D3 and K2 and 5 free AG1 travel packs with your first subscription at drinkag1.com/thestacks. That's drinkag1.com/thestacks. Check it out.
Let's face it, people have different sleep needs. While you love your partner, sleeping next to them might not always be the most comfortable. Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs, so you can choose what's right for each of you whenever you like. Maybe you prefer a firmer mattress and your partner needs something softer. Because of the individualized comfort that you get from Sleep Number Smart Beds, you and your partner will sleep better together. All Sleep Number Smart Beds feature cooling, pressure-relieving comfort layers for soothing sleep throughout the night. And their temperature balancing bedding is designed to move heat and moisture away when you're hot. When you're cool, they hold their energy to help warm you. The smart beds even automatically respond and adjust to your movements, so you sleep comfortably all night long. JD Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number limited edition smart bed for a limited time. For JD Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
I want to transition a little bit more into your process. I know we sort of touched on that a little bit earlier with your trip to Mexico City, but I do want to know sort of what sort of stuff were you watching or listening to or reading while you were in the process of writing this book, if you even remember?
Yeah. Wow. Okay. So I think I definitely was doing a lot of music. I'm one of those people where I feel like if I'm like binge watching a lot of TV, I find it hard to read and vice versa. So with writing, I find it the same. So I think at the time I wasn't really reading or watching much, but I definitely was listening to, I listened to a lot of Mariachi because it was like Frida. And I tried to listen to a lot of her favorite artists. I really was like trying to like set the Frida mood. So I was like, I also listened to the soundtrack to the Frida movie on Netflix, which is on Spotify. I highly recommend. I listened to Rosalia, who is an amazing artist. She's from Spain. She's a flamenco dancer. A flamenco artist, but she also she combines flamenco with like R&B and reggaeton. She's like really creatively, just so I find the way that she approaches music to just be really like creatively inspiring. So I tried to listen to music that I felt like either reminded me or felt like Frida, or that was, even if it was contemporary music, like music that I felt like in my channeling of her that she would have been into. So it was definitely a very like heavily like Spanish or even just like Latin jazz. I tried to kind of dig into that vibe, but also just jazz music like Coltrane. A lot of people don't know, like there were so many little tidbits that I don't even think ended up making it into the book, but like Frida was a big Coltrane fan and she was actually really into jazz. So I was listening to a lot of jazz music also. So it was kind of just like trying to literally channel my like inner Frida through like the things that I felt like she would be listening to and loving.
That's really cool. I didn't ask you this before when you were talking about your writing process, but you know, you listen to the show. This is the most important question, which is, what is your writing setup like? How often are you doing it? Are you having snacks and beverages? What are the rituals? Are you lighting a candle? Like, what is your writing setup?
So writing this book, there was kind of like two versions of my writing self. One was like, I have a deadline that I have to meet and I also have a day job. So it was like, sometimes I didn't have the like bandwidth to do the whole like, I definitely on a normal day, like on a Saturday, here's what it was. It was definitely lighting candles. It was getting my little snacks, setting them up on my desk, putting together my playlist. Like I feel like the preparation before writing was like a 30-minute situation where it was like prepping the playlist, getting my snacks, lighting the candles, making sure I would have like a little backpack in case I like felt like I wanted to, I did want to like change scenery and go to the library or to the coffee shop. So it was definitely a lot of that. And I just, and while I was writing the book, it was a tight deadline. And so because I did have my day job during the week, which meant that I wasn't always able to write during the week, really like Saturdays was like my day where I would just get up early, and I'm not a morning person. So I would have to like get up early and drink my coffee and try to wake myself up. And then I would spend like pretty much every Saturday and most of Sunday is just writing. That was like my writing days for the most part. But then during the week, I would kind of get home and be a little exhausted, but remember that like I still had 40,000 words to write or whatever. Right. And so I would at least try to get like an hour done of writing during the week. But those were the days that I dreaded. I was more like happy when I had like a Saturday and I just knew that the day was ahead of me to just like do my thing.
You evaded the important part. What are the snacks? What are the beverages?
Snacks. Okay. So one thing that I have realized, this is like really getting in the weeds here, but one thing I've realized is that there are certain snacks that are not good for typing. So like there are certain like, you know, like Flaming Hot Cheetos, for instance, not great for your keyboard, right, because your fingers are like super, right? So like there are certain things like I also was like trying to not just like totally eat like crappy shit. Honey Roasted Cashews became like a thing that I, because it's like a good like snack. It gives you a little crunch, but I also didn't feel like I was like just eating like just the worst possible stuff. I'm trying to think what else I would have. Chips and guacamole is like a good, like if I needed just like a break, but I didn't have time to make like a whole full like lunch situation. What else? I'm trying to remember now. I'm like kind of a boring snacker, I feel like, when that's I'm okay. like actually writing, because again, it's like I can't be too messy, right? I'm like, yeah. I have to actually keep my keyboard clean. But yeah, I think that those are probably like the two main snacks. I wish that I had something more interesting, but that's
no, it. Those are great. Some people don't have any snacks. They don't eat. I'm like, you don't eat? What's wrong with you? I hate you.
No.
I eat.
I will say about I'm definitely a coffee fiend. Coffee is definitely like probably how I survived.
Got it.
I survived life period. But also I think this book, I definitely had a lot of caffeine just because, again, I knew I'm not a morning person, but like those morning hours, I had to take advantage of it. So that's what got me through.
Good for you. Good for you. Okay. We have to talk about your other job because you've mentioned it a few times and you're the digital director at Oprah Magazine, which is now also oprahmag.com, which is the website version that you alluded to earlier. How did you, I'm assuming because you're a Black woman that working for Oprah is super fucking exciting to you too, or at least it was when you got started. So I'm curious kind of like, how did that happen? And is it like, I don't know, was it a dream when you met her? Like, I don't know. We have to talk a little bit about Oprah, I feel like.
we must always talk about Oprah. I'll start with the second part of the question, which is it definitely is still a dream to work for her. I think for me, as a Black woman, as a woman, as someone who I grew up with my mom watching the Oprah Winfrey Show, sometimes it's helpful for me to have conversations like this to remind myself like, holy shit, you work for Oprah. Like, yeah. It definitely is. It is, you know, it's amazing. And she is 100%. I think my favorite part about working for her is learning that she is exactly who she presents herself to be. I've, you know, through my job, I have gotten the privilege of interviewing celebrities and meeting people over the years. And it always makes me sad when I realize that like people are, you know, not as nice in real life, or they're, you know, kind of jerks, or that they, you know, present themselves one way on TV or on Instagram or whatever, and that they're really not like that in real life. But the Oprah that we met and then we got to know for years through the Oprah Winfrey Show is the Oprah that you see in person. Like, she just is her most authentic self. And I think that's been the greatest lesson I could have taken from working for her. So the story of how it's a long story, but the short version is that I was an intern at Oprah Magazine right after college. I always wanted to be in magazines, but you know, magazines is a hard world to crack into. It's for, you know, something I would talk about a lot, especially as we're talking about hiring more diverse candidates, for lack of a better word, is, you know, it's definitely a very, it's an industry for privileged white people, to be honest. You know, it's like you have to have the means to move to New York City, to be able to afford, you know, college credits while you were an undergrad, you had to know the right people. And so I always wanted to be in magazines, but I just didn't think I would be able to break into it. So I was on the newspaper route. That was what I was studying, print journalism. I was interning at the New York Daily News after graduation, which was still a big deal. But I actually had met the publisher of 17 magazine. She was a Penn State alum while I was an undergrad. I stalked her in the bathroom after she was speaking at an event. And I was like, I will basically die to like work at a magazine. What help me? Like, what can I do? And she, I think at first was a little scared that this girl had like stalked her in the bathroom, but then she gave me her business card. We stayed in touch. We had coffee. And I think there was just something in me from a young age that like, I don't know where it came from because I was a really shy kid, but I just knew that like I had to take advantage of opportunities when they were in front of me. And so I saw this person and I was like, please give me your business card. And we had lunch a few times. And then when I saw there was an internship, a post-grad internship opening that was paid at Oprah Magazine, which is under Hearst, the same company as 17. She, you know, basically found out who the best contact was, put me in touch with the contact. And that was how I got my foot in the door. And I started as an intern. And then I later became Gail King's assistant. I was Gail's assistant for about 4 years. That was literally the dream job. Working for Gail was like, I can't even, like, I could talk about working for Gail King all day long. She is literally, she is an angel. She is just, she is incredible. So my first 6 years of my career was at O. And then I was ready to spread my wings. So I left and I went to Us Weekly. And I was an entertainment editor there. And then I went to Refinery 29, where I was a senior features writer for a few years. And then in 2018, Hearst decided that they wanted to finally, after much, much long delay, that they wanted to launch an editorial website for Oprah Magazine. And so I came back to Hearst to launch the site. And that's where I've been since.
Wow. That's pretty crazy. I love that you stalked that woman or man or that person. because it, first of all, it is very Frida in how she kind of got her foot in the door with Diego. I mean, you didn't create a marriage out of that, but it's that same kind of energy. It's definitely that what would Frida do energy, which is like show up and demand to be paid attention to, which I sort of love that sort of symmetry. But also, did you read More Than Enough by Elaine Welterworth or whatever?
Yes.
She has sort of a similar intro story as well into how she got into magazines. And I'm sure, again, another Black woman that you probably feel some connection to just based on being in similar worlds. Okay, this is sort of a creepy question, but it is begging to be asked.
I love creepy questions.
What does Oprah smell like?
Oh my gosh, it's so funny. If I had like it's like I always just wonder. I'm like, why is that what people? It's like the one thing people want to know is what she smells like. It's like this. It's not like, is her skin smooth? It's her like no. It's always
is her skin smooth?
Her skin is smooth. No, she smells. She smells great. She smells. I'm sure I know. I don't even remember off the top of my head, but she definitely has like a signature scent. But she smells very fresh and light.
Okay. I'm going to get off the Oprah thing. Though, if Oprah wants to come onto the Sax podcast, just you can tell her there is always an opening for her. If she's available, I am available. But that's it for Oprah.
Noted.
I am curious, sort of, you'd mentioned that like you were very busy in your day life and then you also have, you know, this book that you're writing. So what is different? Because you wrote at Refinery 29, you do write stuff. It's not all just digital content in the sense that it's like videos, like you're also creating written pieces. So what's the difference for you sort of writing this book versus writing these pieces or creating content or whatever you want to call it in your day job? How do those things kind of butt up against each other?
I think I really missed, I mean, I had never written a book before, but I think I missed writing a lot more. So at Oprah, what my job really looks like is our site publishes like between 12 to 15 stories a day. So a lot of my job is editing. It's also greenlighting pitches. It's kind of the more big picture editorial stuff, working with our advertising team, all that kind of stuff, which is all fun and great in its own right. But I think I'm a writer at my core and at my heart. And that was my favorite part of Refinery, where I was a senior features writer, was just writing sometimes like, you know, personal essays or opinion pieces or reported features. But still, even all of those kinds of pieces that you write as a journalist are different than a book. And so for me, I think, as I mentioned, the trip to Mexico and just like kind of finally freeing myself of like, here's how I was taught to write, or here's how, you know, what it's like to write for someone else. Or I think a big thing that we think about as writers, as journalists, is like writing for the voice of whatever outlet you're writing for, right? So for Oprah, I know that we're writing for our reader who is like in her early 40s and loves all things cozy and drinks wine and like is really into the royals. Like there's like things that I know about our reader. I call her Janet, by the way. She has like a full personality. She has like a whole profile. So I know Janet, and I know when I'm writing for O or when I'm editing my team stories, I know what Janet's looking for. Just like at Refinery, I knew that it was like we were writing for like the millennial, young, empowered woman. Like it's you have that in mind. Versus with this book, I felt like it was like a fresh slate, and I kind of had in mind who I wanted the reader to be. I knew that this was a book. I wanted it to be a book primarily for women and also for women of color. I feel like we're the ones who need that inspiration most. So I knew that was my target reader, but I also knew that like I had so much more space to just write how I wanted to write and write in my own voice and do my own thing and to put Ariana into it as opposed to just Ariana the journalist. So I think for me, that was the biggest difference, was like having this clean slate and just being able to have fun with it. And like, if I did want to write about like the ghost of Frida haunting me in the middle of the night, like, why not? Who says I can? It's me. It's my book. So I think I just was able to have a little bit more fun. I keep saying the word fun, which probably sounds super nerdy because I'm talking about writing. But like for me, it was fun because it was just like getting to actually like write how I wanted to write it without as many restraints as I think I normally would have.
Yeah. That makes sense. Did you name your reader for your book? Like, does Janet have a daughter or was it?
Oh my God. I haven't. I really haven't. You know, I think the reader of the book in my mind, I talk in the book about Frida fans and how I think that our nickname, if we could nickname ourselves, would be Friduchas, which is like a play on, she used to call some of her students Friduchas, which was a play on her nickname, her childhood nickname. So I think that that's kind of the reader that I had in mind. But I also did want to expand it beyond, like, I was imagining people in the bookstore who like literally know nothing about Frida and don't really care about her, but are like, this book cover is pretty, or like, I could use a book about inspiration right now. So I don't want to just limit it to like super Frida fans either. So I kind of just like kept it a little bit more open-ended, I think.
Yeah. I'm not a super Frida fan. And so I think I probably fall into that second category of people who are like, okay, sure, I'm interested. Yeah. Like, I don't know. I didn't know much about her. Though I do have a weird family connection, and this is sort of family lore, so maybe it's not true, but my grandfather allegedly was was one of the translators for Diego Rivera when he painted the murals in New York City. I don't know if that's true. That's what my aunt, who was into like family tree, whatever stuff, like told us, but I don't know. I couldn't find anything about him. Like, his name's not anywhere, so who knows? But he did speak like 13 languages, so it's believable, and I'm gonna go with it. But like, if someone else is like, no, that was actually Bill Johnson, then like, okay, fine, it's a lie, but I believe.
I would want to read a book about him and his life, though. Like, that totally sounds to me like a story of like, imagine like you're a translator for some of the coolest artists in history, that, and like, you probably have seen so much stuff, but nobody knows your name. Oh my God.
Yeah.
Book idea right there. There,
okay,
you go.
Well, I
somebody
don't write.
So. Somebody write it.
Someone write it and do research.
Somebody write it.
Yes. And please give me the royalties off of this acclaimed book that's coming out. Okay. I just have a few more questions for you. One, of course, super important, which is, what is a word you can never spell correctly on the first try?
Word I can never spell correctly. For some reason, I can never spell the word rhythm. I don't know why. Ugh. It's like I always struggle in wrong places. Yeah, like the H and the Y, and then there's like two H's, was like always throws me off. That, I think rhythm is a word. I'm literally like typing to think about it. Oh, and for some reason, Wednesday, the day of the week, I can't, like, that weird N after the D. Like, I'm always like, when did in this day? Like,
yes.
Those are two words that like I always struggle with for some reason.
Those are definitely, Wednesday is a word I can spell, but only because in like elementary school, I started just calling it Wednesday because that's the only way I could do it. And rhythm,
right.
A nearly impossible word. There's not enough vowels. It's like, there's like 12 letters, right. And there's one Y. And I'm like, what are you doing? Like, get a friend.
There should be an I in there somewhere. Like, it's a very weird word.
It is. Okay. I want to know, because your book came out in the pandemic, how did you celebrate Publication Day? What did you do to kind of honor this accomplishment in your life?
Well, on the day of the book coming out, I did a lot of Instagram lives. That was kind of like, the thing has just been like Instagram lives and Zoom. So on the day that it came out, I mean, it was a little sad, I'm not going to lie, because I was like, I would be probably at Barnes & Noble or at a bookstore right now doing a book signing. But But no, I had so many, like my sister and my parents and like loved ones sent me like bottles of bubbly and flowers. And I was just like here in my apartment. I literally decided like the morning of, I was like, I'm going to do something on social media to like commemorate this. So I like put on my most like Frida like outfit and just tried to literally think about what would Frida do. Like she would not be here at home feeling sorry for herself. Like you just had a book come out. So I was like, I need to like make it feel special. So I put on like a very cute Frida outfit. I took some pictures with the book and posted them. I drank a lot of tequila that day and just like, you know, got a lot of love for friends and family. So that was the day of kind of what that day was like. And it ended up being super busy just between, you know, doing some interviews and promo and things like that, all virtual, of course. But then I think my like big adventure was I went to Mexico, my first pandemic travel moment. I went back to Mexico City with my best friend Joseph, who works with me at Oprah Magazine. And we, you know, we were feeling in a place like, keep in mind, I've been in a studio apartment by myself since March. And I was just like, I think if I spend another day alone here in New York, I'm just going to lose it. And so we were at a point where we felt like we felt comfortable enough. And I feel like travel and the pandemic is like totally a personal decision. But for me, I felt comfortable enough where we were like, we were going to go to Mexico City. We just stayed in an Airbnb, just the two of us. And we literally just worked remotely, but at least we were like together and we could walk around and just, we went to La Casa Azul. And that was for me, I think the celebration of like, you did this thing. This feels like a special way to celebrate. Let's go back to where it all started. And that was super awesome. And it felt like a very full circle moment, like exactly a year later. And Mexico City is one of my favorite cities in the world, both because of this book and also just because, I don't know, there's something about the energy there. And I think just the vibe and the visuals and the architecture of the city that just really inspired me to write. So it actually got me inspired to write again on maybe my next book.
That was my next question, which is, do you know what is next for you?
Not officially, but I am working on something. I hope it'll turn into something, but it is a novel. It's fiction, which I'm like, I think everyone's like surprised because it's so funny because I never would have thought that my first book would be like a biography. And right. I'm like, no, I want to write like this is like, I've always just been a fiction girl. So, I am working on like a little something. It's not like official yet, but I will keep you posted once I know for sure what it will be. But I've honestly just been really excited that I have been inspired to write again. I think just because this pandemic and like all of the down energy of everything that's been going on. And also, you know, again, like I think because of my day job, a lot of the times I am kind of creatively a little zapped by the end of the day. So the fact that I've been inspired to write, I'm like, let me strike while the iron is hot and see where this goes.
Yeah, I like that. That's exciting for you. I'm glad that you got, again, Mexico City, your creative muse, I guess. For folks who love What Would Frida Do? What are some other books that you might recommend to them?
You know, I knew you were going to ask me this because, again, I'm a fan of the podcast. And I was thinking about it and I was like, what would I recommend? Because I do think that the book is so unique in that it's very specifically about Frida. But I think it's unique in that it's like a biography, but it's also like kind of self-help. And I haven't really like come across a lot of books that kind of like do that double dance of like self-help and biography. I mean, I definitely think like if you are a super Frida fan and you want even more than like what I gave the biography from 1983 by Hayden Herrera, which is just Frida, that is an amazing read because there's like tons more detail there about her life that I couldn't even get into in my book. But what are other books that I would recommend? I think that's kind of it. Again, because like I think for me, the problem is that I read so much fiction that I'm just like everything I can think of is like a novel. Like there are so many books that I read this year that I absolutely loved, but they're nothing like my book. So it's like the total opposite.
Have you ever heard of the book called The Creative Habit by Twyla Tharp? Do you know that book?
A few people have mentioned it to me, but I haven't read it.
So that's a book that I might pair with this. Twyla Tharp is a very famous choreographer. She choreographed the musical Moving Out. So a lot of people would know her from that. And she writes a book about just being creative. So it's sort of a very small part of your book, but they do kind of pair nicely because it talks about her and the art that she creates, the choreography that she does. And because she's sort of a celebrity type person, it's a little bit memoir-y and then also much more about how she actually creates, like the ways in which she creates ritual around that and stuff. So they're kind of similar, super different, but also kind of in conversation, I would say.
I have to check this out because you're like the third person I feel like who has mentioned this book to me. So I definitely want to check it out because I'm literally looking at like my stacks of books here and it's literally all like rom-coms, novels. Like I just finished last night The Invisible Life of Addie LaRue, which was such a great, I like could not put that book down. Mexican Gothic, I also like Mexican Gothic comes to mind because it's set in Mexico and it's it was such a brilliantly written book and I feel like it just like transported me to Mexico in many of the ways that I hope that you know What Would Frida Do would do, but it's also like a gothic horror novel set in like the 1960s, so it's not necessarily the same, but that was a book that I really loved.
I feel like sometimes it doesn't have to necessarily be the same, but just kind of books are in conversation or that kind of spark on certain things. Cause you know, like if you read a book that you love, you don't want to go and read the exact same book, but just like a different subject. You kind of want to like read around it and kind of like live in it. So I feel like those are good combos to mix with your book. Who has been the most exciting person for you that expressed interest in your book?
Oh, the most exciting person. I mean, for me, so Gail, who obviously is a little biased because she's my former boss, but Gail King, who is also a host on CBS This Morning, the morning that the book came out, I had no idea that she was going to do this. But on CBS This Morning, they do like their pick of the day or whatever, where they talk about like things happening in the news or like interesting things that they want people to know about. And Gail brought up my book and talked about how, you know, she read the book and how much she loved it. And I was just like so surprised because I was like, you know, I knew that she would, I hoped that she would support it in some like small way, but I was like shocked that it was on CBS This Morning and she was talking about it. And it was also just a very full circle moment because she was my former boss and she literally is like the person that I owe so much to. So her, I think talking about the book was amazing. Also Nina Garcia, who's the editor in chief of Elle and of Project Runway fame. She blurbed the book, which I could not believe it that she did that. And she had such nice things to say about the book. So I think, and I, you know, I've looked up to her for so long as both a journalist and as a Latina. So I think the two of them were like kind of really big heavy hitters where I was like, oh snap, like, okay, this book is like getting real visibility now. And it just, it was so, so overwhelming.
Oh my gosh. Okay. This is my last question for you. Who is one person dead or alive you would want to read this book?
I mean, is the obvious answer Frida?
I sort of like feel like Frida, it is.
Right? Like, that's the most obvious answer. So, aside from Frida, the person I would really want to read this book. Honestly, I've been dying to get the book into the hands of Selma Hayek because she played Frida in the movie. And I would be, like, I just would love to hear her thoughts as somebody who also had to really, like, immerse herself into the life and, like, channel into Frida's life and channel her energy and, I think that she did such an incredible job portraying her. And she also, like, over the years has just been such a big fan of hers and talking about and sharing her art and her legacy. And so I think that if Selma Hayek is out there, like, I've tried reaching out to her team and I'm like, I really want to get my book into her hands. But she's someone that comes to mind, I think, because I feel like she would be a dream person in that she would get the like love and fascination with Frida. And also I would just like want to know her thoughts and like, does she think that I got it right? And did she like also find this part interesting and all that kind of stuff?
Yeah, that's a really, really good answer. Aside from obviously Frida. Well, Ariana, thank you so much for being here. Everyone at home, you can grab the book, What Would Frida Do? A Guide to Living Boldly by Ariana Davis. Wherever you get your books, it is out in the world. It is, we didn't even talk about the cover, but it is beautiful. The book is gorgeous. Inside, it's gorgeous as well. It's not just Ariana's prose, but there's also quotes and sort of fun listicle type things. So please, please, please check out the book wherever you got your books. And Ariana, thank you for being here.
Thank you so much for having me. My Bookstagram podcast girl crush. I'm so happy to be here. This is so lovely and so much fun.
Well, thank you. And everyone else, we will see you in the stacks. Thank you to Ariana Davis for being my guest. The Stacks Book Club selection for December is Citizen, an American Lyric by Claudia Rankine. We will be discussing this book on December 30th with Darnell Moore. Please make sure you're subscribed to The Stacks wherever you listen to your podcasts. And if you're listening through Apple Podcasts, be sure to leave us a rating and a review. For more from The Stacks, follow us on social media at The Stacks Pod on Instagram and at The Stacks Pod _ on Twitter. And check out the website, thestackspodcast.com. Today's episode was edited and produced by Sebastian Alcala. Our graphic designer is Robin McCrite, and our theme music is from Tigirigis. The Stacks is created and produced by me, Tracy Thomas.